Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Kia ora, everyone. I'd like to welcome Professor Guy McPherson and our listeners to my first show as host on Nature Bats Last. And most especially, I'd like to thank Guy for trusting me to carry on the legacy of NBL on PRN.fm. Many thanks to Gary Null for creating such a magnificent platform and AfroZen for his fantastic theme music. We're living in a biosphere and hospice. And the role I see for the show is to try and join the dots and go where most fear to travel. I suspect this journey will be much shorter than most people realise, but regular listeners to NBL are already expecting a sudden and brutal end. Let's try and prepare for the inevitable, to embrace every day like it's our last, and indulge in some gallows humour on the road to Armageddon. If you're ready, Guy, I'd like to first quote a stunning recent article from Global Research entitled Biological Annihilation on Earth Accelerating, Population Extinctions, Entire Animal Species Destroyed. And then you and I could discuss the article and recent events that are happening all around the world as we speak. And all as a result of our addiction, our crack-like addiction to carbon and the near total lack of leadership from the dominant culture. Guy, did you manage to get a decent internet connection?
Well, I'll leave that to you to decide, Kevin. Thanks for having me on the show today, and thank you for taking over the reins of Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine. Thank you very much.
Awesome.
Right, I'll get to the article, the headline article that I'd like to discuss. Human beings are now waging war against life itself as we continue to destroy not just individual lives, local populations and entire species in vast numbers, but also destroy the ecological systems that make life on Earth possible. By doing this, we are now accelerating the sixth mass extinction event in Earth's history, and virtually eliminating any prospect of human survival. In a recently published article, scientific article, Biological Annihilation via the ongoing sixth mass extinction signaled by vertebrate population losses and declines. The authors, Gerardo Ceballos, Paul Ehrlich, and Rodolfo Durso, document the accelerating nature of this problem. Quote, Earth's sixth mass extinction is more severe than perceived when looking exclusively at species extinctions. That conclusion is based on analysis of the numbers and degrees of range contraction. Using a sample of 27,600 vertebrate species and on a more detailed analysis documenting the population extinctions between 1900 and 2015 in 177 mammal species. Their research found that the rate of population loss in terrestrial vertebrates is extremely high, even in species of low concern. I'll just add my own comment on that is that one of the first species that has gone extinct in most of the previous extinction events have been the vertebrates. And apart from the leaders that we have running the world at the moment, most of us are invertebrates. The people I see at the top don't seem to have any spine at all. I'll get back to the article. In their sample, comprising nearly half of known vertebrate species, 32% are decreasing. That is, they have decreased in population size and range. In the 177 mammals for which they had detailed data, all had lost 30% or more of their geographic ranges, and more than 40% of the species had experienced severe population declines. Their data revealed that beyond global species extinctions, Earth is experiencing a high episode of population declines and extirpations, which will have negative cascading consequences on ecosystem functioning and services vital to sustaining civilization. Notice how a lot of these articles all talk about sustaining civilization. It's all about us humans. Even with these great scientists, it can still be about us humans. Back to the article. We describe this as a biological annihilation to highlight the current magnitude of Earth's ongoing sixth major extinction event. Illustrating the damage done by dramatically reducing the historic graphic range of a species, consider the lion. Panthera leo was historically distributed over most of Africa, southern Europe, and the Middle East, all the way to the northwestern India. It is now confined to scattered populations in sub-Saharan Africa and a remnant population in the Gir forest of India. The vast majority of lion populations are gone. Why is this happening, questions Sibelius, Ehrlich, and Dirtzo tell us. In the last few decades, habitat loss, over-exploitation, invasive organisms, toxification, and more recently climate disruption, as well as the interactions among these factors, have led to the catastrophic declines in both the numbers and size of populations of both common and rare vertebrate species. Further, however, the authors warn that the true extent of this mass extinction has been underestimated because of the emphasis on species extinction. This estimate can be traced to overlooking the accelerating extinction of local populations of species. Population extinctions today are orders of magnitude more frequent than species extinctions. Population extinctions, however, are a prelude to species extinctions. So Earth's sixth mass extinction episode has proceeded further than most assume. Moreover, and importantly from a narrow human perspective, the massive loss of local populations is already damaging the services ecosystems provided to civilization, which of course are given no value by governments and corporate economists. As Sibelius, Ehrlich, and Dirtzo remind us, when considering this frightening assault on the foundations of human civilization, one must never forget the Earth's capacity to support life, including human life, has been shaped by life itself. When public mention is made of extinction crisis, it usually focuses on a few probably iconic animal species known to have gone extinct, while protecting many more and by projecting many more in future. However, a glance at their maps presents a much more realistic picture. As much as 50% of the number of animal individuals that once shared Earth with us are already gone, as are billions of populations. Furthermore, they claim that their analysis is conservative, given the increasing trajectories of these factors that drive extinction together with their synergistic impacts. Further losses easily may amount to a further rapid deformation of the globe and comparable loss of the diversity of plants, including the local and eventually global deformation-driven co-extinction of plants. They conclude with the chilling observation. Thus, we emphasize that the sixth mass extinction is already here and the window for effective action is very short. Like every other article, they always have a dose of hopium thrown in to just sweeten the bitter reality. Back to the article. Of course, it is too late for those species of plants, birds, animals, fish, amphibians, insects, and reptiles that humans have already driven to extinction or will yet drive to extinction in the future. 200 species yesterday, 200 species today, 200 tomorrow, 200 the day after. And as Ceballos, Ehrlich, and Dirtso emphasize, the ongoing daily extinctions of a myriad of local populations. If you think that the above information is bad enough in assessing the prospects of human survival, you'll not be encouraged by awareness or deeper consideration of even some of the many variables adversely impacting our prospects that were beyond the scope of the study. While Ceballos, Ehrlich, and Dirtso, in addition to the problems they noted, which are cited above, also identified the problems of human overpopulation and continued population growth, as well as overconsumption, based on the fiction that perpetual growth can occur on a finite planet, and even the risks posed by nuclear war. There were many variables that were well beyond the scope of their research. For example, in a recent discussion of that branch of ecological science known as planetary boundary science, Dr. Glenn Barry identified at least 10 global ecological catastrophes which threatened to destroy the global ecological system and portend an end to human beings and perhaps all life. Ranging from nitrogen deposition to ocean acidification and including such basics as soil, water, and air, virtually every ecological system which life depends on is failing. And it references the end of being abrupt climate change, one of many ecological crises threatening to collapse the biosphere. Moreover, apart from the ongoing human death tolls caused by the endless wars and other military violence being conducted on across the planet, see, for example, the Yemen cholera is the worst on record and numbers still rising. There is a catastrophic environmental damage being caused. For some insights, see the toxic remnants of war project. In addition, the out-of-control methane releases into the atmosphere that are now occurring. References 7,000 underground gas bubbles poised to explode in the Arctic, and the release of the Arctic methane may be apocalyptic, the study warns. And the release, each and every day, of 300 tons of radioactive waste from Fukushima into the Pacific are having disastrous consequences that will negatively impact life on Earth indefinitely. And they cannot be reversed in any time frame that is meaningful for human prospects. Apart from above, there is a host of other critical issues, such as destruction of Earth's rainforests, destruction of waterways and the ocean habitat, and the devastating impact of animal agriculture for meat consumption. That international governmental organizations such as the UN, national governments, and multinational corporations will continue to refuse to decisively act upon because they are controlled by the insane global elite. So time may be short, the number of issues utterly daunting, and the prospects of life for life grim. But if you, like me, are inclined to fight to the last breath, I invite you to consider making a deliberate choice to take powerful action in the fight for our survival. More hopium, you can see chucked in there as we get to the end. If you're involved or considering being involved in local campaigns to arrest climate change, end some manifestation of war or war, and to halt any other threat to our environment, I consider you doing so as best you can. I think we'll leave that detail about that article and we'll get back to Guy, you and I having a discussion about it. How do you feel about that article, Guy?
I think it's great, you know, and it's telling that it's written by conservation biologists. It was Ceballos, Gerardo Ceballos and colleagues who wrote the first paper a little over 2 years ago, early summer 2015, pointing out that we are in the midst of the sixth mass extinction. This is, you know, a decade or two after books had been written indicating we are in the midst of the sixth mass extinction. But the Referee Journal literature is always the last to know, always the last to report the situation that we actually find ourselves in. So we interviewed Gerardo Ceballos shortly after that for this program. But it's conservation biologists who understand speciation, extinction, and habitat, the three pillars underlying the existence of every species on the planet, including ours. And so it's no big surprise that they are now pointing out, some 2 years after the paper, the original paper in Science Advances, they're now pointing out that it's far worse than we imagine, far worse than we have been reporting so far. Of course it is. I mean, that's the nature of abrupt climate change. That's the nature of pretty much every untoward aspect associated with industrial civilization, is that it's occurring faster than expected and worse than expected. And it seems there's little being done to even talk about these issues, much less deal with them in any meaningful way. So it's great. And so it surprised me when it came out. This paper came out in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences earlier this year. And the amazing thing to me is that the term biological annihilation appeared in the title. In the title of a Refereed Journal article in a prestigious journal, such as Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. My apologies for the background noise. I'm here in the Maya Mountains and surrounded by parrots and toucans and all kinds of interesting tropical birds, and I can't get them to recognize that we're in the midst of an important radio show here.
Don't apologize for that. All of those natural sounds are going away. I think it's absolutely perfect to have it as a background music to this discussion. I was also happy with that article where they sort of went outside the normal parameters and they talked about the role that war is playing in the ecological catastrophe that's taking place around the world. It's a vastly underestimated and not discussed aspect of these horrendous imperialist wars that are taking place, about how much ecological destruction takes place as a result. We see in the jousting between the United States and Russia at the moment, that, and of course North Korea, that they're all tooling up. They're all getting ready for what seems like an inevitable conflict. And not only is that the coming conflict going to be horrendous ecologically, but the practice and the training and the military-industrial complex profiteering from what's happening is also contributing enormously to the catastrophic situation we find ourselves in.
Yes, of course. And here I'd like to insert something. You mentioned something about technological species and modern technology and the contribution of the field of planetary sciences to our demise. And here's a quote from the International Journal of Astrobiology from August 3rd of this year in a paper by Whitmire. And the quote is, "The typical technological species becomes extinct soon after attaining a modern technology, and this event results in the extinction of the planet's global biosphere," end quote. So it's basically just a restatement of Fermi's paradox, that once a technological species becomes sufficiently advanced, quote unquote, then it's a short step to annihilation of the planet's biosphere. And it looks like we're there, or at least on the verge of attaining that great status, our own species.
It's incredible that we are having this conversation and we are alive at this time in the planetary history and the history of our species. I think I understand why so many people struggle to believe that we could all be staring at the end of our species and that we could be bearing witness to it. But I would imagine the last few dodos and the last few humans on Easter Island were having similar conversations. One of the things that you and I and people in our circle are often accused of is that we are alarmists. And I'd like to bring up the point of a famous alarmist in 1937 called Winston Churchill. He was going around Europe and saying to everyone he could, who would listen to him, that we were facing an enormous disaster and that we had to act. And nothing was done. And then we stumbled into war, into a war against the Nazi Germany, in which 60 or 80 million people were dead in 8 brutal years. I think in the next 8 brutal years, we vastly more than that number of people died.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more about that. And as with every civilization, there are people who have been sounding the alarm about the two things, that civilization is going away. This civilization, like all others, has always been 9 meals away from utter catastrophe, and that there are untoward aspects. There are disadvantages associated with civilization. You know, people who don't recognize their own privilege, much less admit to it, are probably not going to see that there are people dying so that we can keep the lights on, are not going to admit that 200 species are being driven to extinction every day, that the erosion's going on and the fouling of the air and the dirtying of the water and on the list goes, that those are outcomes of this set of living arrangements, as with prior versions of civilization. So if you aren't even willing to have the conversation on anything that matters, then of course you're not going to make significant steps to turning the sucker around. And here we are, I'd say, if a few decades, maybe a few centuries too late for that turning around to begin.
Absolutely. I would go so far as to say that there is only one sapien in Puerto Rico at the moment who doesn't believe that collapse is unfolding. And that person, that particular sapien, and I'm only going to mention this person's name once because I don't want to turn off all our listeners. His name is Donald J. Trump. He has just arrived in Puerto Rico, and he was greeted at the airport by the wonderful mayor of what's the capital city of? Yes, San Juan. Her name is Cruz, and she went to the airport to meet Trump, and he refused to meet her because he's been accusing her of bagging him on Twitter. Who would do that? But I don't think you'll find very many souls in Puerto Rico who don't see collapse unfolding. Would you agree?
Yeah, I agree. There's a lot of people in Puerto Rico who might not be on the same page as President Trump, like all of them.
Sorry, my line's breaking up here for a second. I missed that. Can you just step in, Guy, while I sort something out?
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of things going on today that mirror relatively recent events. People are comparing Donald Trump's handling of the Puerto Rico situation with George W. Bush's handling or absence thereof of Hurricane Katrina when it hit New Orleans. And obviously there are some parallels and there are some differences as well. But I would argue that the president doesn't have nearly as much power as most people think the president has, president of the United States, and that it's essentially impossible to serve the imperialists at the helm, the people who really are calling the shots on what the United States government does. It's really difficult to appease those people while also dealing with the hundreds of thousands, millions, in the near future, billions of people who are suffering and dying, because those are obviously at opposite ends of the spectrum. How do you think the 1% get to be 1% in terms of financial wealth, if not by exploitation, if not through colonization, if not through all of these untoward elements associated with this and other civilizations? So you can't have four or five people having as much wealth as half of the people in the world and expect those four or five to make some sort of serious sacrifices for the poorer half of the people in the world. So I no longer have great expectations of Homo sapiens sapiens, the self-proclaimed, doubly proclaimed wise ape. Rather, I think that what we are seeing is the unraveling of the entire society alongside the unraveling of the global climate. And I don't think we should be terribly surprised about all that. I think that they are one in the same package. We are human animals dependent upon habitat for our survival. As the habitat goes away, a product of sociological decisions made in the past, it will, of course, impact the sociology of the future. How could it not? One of the long expected outcomes of taking a scorched earth approach to policy at the highest levels of government is that you end up with a scorched earth. Well, what do you know? Here we are, scorched earth and all. Planet Easter Island.
Some of us who have been involved in this dichotomy for decades have been warning about crossing tipping points. And we know that once you cross a number of tipping points, you reach a point of no return, and then you get into the exponential unraveling. We're in that position now, and the main ecological organizations aren't prepared to admit it. They're all still in the same old paradigm of, if we can just stop using plastic bags at the supermarket. Not taking plastic bags from the supermarket is a great idea. I'm a supporter of it, but it's not going to change in any way the outcome of where we're going. And I think there's a real cognitive dissonance in that community where we've reached that point now and no one's prepared to accept it. It's really quite an amazing psychological dichotomy taking place.
Well, yeah. And, we all want to have hope. We all want to wish that if we just do a few minor things that it's all going to turn out fine. We also like to blame. It's part of human nature. So if we can just find a fault with somebody or something, then we can point at that person or that entity or that institution, and we can say, see, it's not me. I'm doing fine. Everything I'm doing is all right. I'm going to keep recycling and I'm going to keep conserving and so on. It's somebody else. It's that entity over there. And from my perspective, I'm just a little tired of the blame game, of the shaming, of the using of guilt, all that, when we are all here. We are all here within civilization, guilty as charged, born into captivity, and knowing no other way out. So what does it accomplish to point the finger at other more horrible people than us? Of course, we can always find more horrible people than others. I imagine most of us can find people who are better than us as well. But very few of us go around pointing those people out. We love pointing out other people's flaws. We really don't like pointing out other people's virtues.
In the context of what you've just said, I think that we see this from organizations like 350.org and Bill McKibben, where they're telling young people, you have to fix this. Excuse me? We dumped this shit on the youth of this planet, and now we're telling them to fix it? How spectacularly unreasonable is that? What a load and a weight to dump on their shoulders. And, at the end of the day, they know, when you say that, they know we're lying to them. I speak a lot to quite young people. I've been speaking at a university in Auckland recently, and I have a lot of contact with young people. And they're really switched on about how bad the situation is. And they're really pissed off that we're telling them that they have to fix it. It's a real poke in the eye for young people.
Yes, it certainly is, and it goes beyond 350.org and McKibben and crew. It goes to the Referee Journal literature, where James Hansen and colleagues recently had a paper published. I'm looking for the title now and probably not going to be able to come up with it in short order, but the title includes the phrase young people's burden, and the paper is about the topic of removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So it admits and dumps it on future generations to remove carbon from the atmosphere that we and previous generations put into the atmosphere. So obviously this is patently unfair and not at all surprising for that matter. So, you know, when you, this is to me as bad, maybe even worse than playing the blame game and pointing out whose fault something was. This is a paper in the journal Earth System Dynamics that says that we have to have young people. It is on their shoulders to clean up the atmosphere. We're already in overshoot. We already have too much methane and too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so what Hansen and colleagues are saying is young people are going to have to fix our mess. Well, this is absurd. Not only is the mess unfixable, but to point to other people to clean up our own mess is the height of unrecognized, unacknowledged privilege.
Absolutely. I've just heard that we have a caller, Guyo, and maybe the studio could plug him in and we'll hear what Guyo has to say.
Hey, welcome, Kevin. I'm glad you're taking over the show.
Thank you very much, Guyo. How are you today?
Good. This is great. Hi, Guy. How you doing?
Hey, Guyo. It's great to hear from you. Haven't seen you for a while. Too long, in fact.
Yeah. Boy, it's good to hear you both. I'm just thinking, you know, we're just one disaster away from that breaks the back of the economy, and that's really what collapse is. I mean, it won't be a total collapse, but it just seems like we're so close to what it's going to change things and will never be the same. And that's all I had to say.
Well, I'd like to say one part of your economy, the U.S. economy, has collapsed, and that's Puerto Rico. That's totally collapsed. But for some reason, whilst the United States controls it and owns it and exploits it, when the shit hits the fan, it's taken them a very long time to show up.
Yeah, that's right. This is the United States, after all, allegedly the richest country in the world. At least that's the story I heard the whole time I was growing up. So if the richest country on the planet can't get their act together to alleviate the suffering of its own citizens, then are we not willing to admit that collapse is underway at this point?
I would like to say about that I believe that, like so often is the case in these discussions, racism is a major part of this issue. They're not really us, are they? Us being Americans, inverted commas.
Yeah, and, you know, again, we return to these same topics time and again, the notion of blaming, the notion of expecting somebody else to clean up our mess. I just found the title of that paper in Earth System Dynamics. It's titled Young People's Burden, Requirement of Negative CO2 Emissions. It's by Hansen and more than a dozen other authors. And so now it's a requirement. It's not an expectation. It's a demand. It's a requirement that young people, other people's generation, not my generation, young people's generation, they're going to have to fix the mess created by the worst generation in the history of humanity, in my opinion, the one that I'm part of.
Well, we shouldn't be surprised by that, because the IPCC projections rely on fantasy technology. Their projections going forward require carbon sequestration techniques and methodology that doesn't exist. I have a post on my website at kevinhester.live where I bring that point up with some very good video documentation from Nick Brees, again, our fantastic Nick Brees, who's done so much very good work on climate change, where they're talking about carbon sequestration technology that is fantasy.
No, you're absolutely right. And in fact, I point out in my recent presentations, I point out two paradoxes that we currently face. One, we need fantastic technology. We need to remove carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases from the atmosphere if we're to maintain habitat for our favorite species going into the future. But the other side of that coin is that, as you point out, it's fantasy technology. In fact, the referee journal literature summarized and integrated by the United States National Academy of Sciences and by a European body of similar stature, both in 2015, indicated this is fantasy technology. So that's the first paradox. We have to do this thing that can't be done, or we're going to lose habitat for our species. So that's the first one. The second one is that civilization is a heat engine. This is based primarily on the work of Tim Garrett, atmospheric scientist at the University of Utah. Civilization itself is a heat engine, regardless of how it is powered. And yet, if we turn off the heat engine that is civilization, the planet heats up even faster as a result of the absence of global dimming. So, there's no way out. We're truly damned if we do and damned if we don't. We have these two paradoxes. If either one of them was not present, we'd still be going extinct in the near future. And there's two of them, and those are just the two that I'm recognizing. I'm sure there are many more components leading to our demise than I've managed to put together. And then there's the unspeakable that we haven't talked about, Kevin, which is what happens when we get a little sea level rise? What happens when civilization goes away? What happens to the world's 400-plus nuclear power facilities that are Fukushima hovering on the brink? So there's way more here than meets the eye, and try to have a conversation about it and still maintain friends and family members. Good luck with that.
I think that's the role for this show. It has been historically, and I would like to keep it that way going forward, is that we try and join the dots that no one else is joining. Recently, when Hurricane Harvey came out of the Caribbean and went onto the Texas, on the mainland of the USA, there were a number of nuclear power stations that were in the crosshairs of Harvey. And those nuclear power station operators had days and days of notice that Harvey was going to come and that it was going to be catastrophic. And they kept generating electricity. Some of them kept generating right through. One of them had an emergency scram. Now, the reason that they kept going is that they get paid relative to their reliability. So if they go offline on the grid, they lose some of their revenue. So these corporations, these nuclear psychopaths, kept generating electricity when there were 200-mile-per-hour winds forecast and did arrive. They took the complete chance that it would be okay. And we dodged a bullet. You and I had a conversation a few days ago about bullet dodging. It seems to me that we are almost like the people in Las Vegas in the middle of the concert, and bullets are raining down on us, and it's only now a matter of luck if we don't get hit, and we are living day to day, hour to hour, minute by minute.
I couldn't agree more. You know, we talk about dodging the nuclear bullet, and I'm amazed we've lasted this long. It's pretty clear that the Pacific Ocean will be suffering indefinitely into the future in terms of complex life. And, of course, that's headed our way as well, because without oceans to provide habitat for us, we won't continue to persist into the future. But what we were talking about was the analysis conducted largely by members of the U.S. Naval Postgraduate College in 2012, predicting an ice-free Arctic in 2016, plus or minus 3 years. And we dodged that bullet again this year, the fifth year in a row that the plus or minus 3 years has come into play. So up through September of this year, when the ice unexpectedly began to refreeze in the Arctic, we've now gone through five of those years of the 2016 plus or minus three that the ice was predicted to have gone away in the Arctic Ocean. And this is, people really don't understand how important the ice in the Arctic Ocean is. The Arctic is the planetary air conditioner. That's what keeps the whole planet cool enough for humans to persist. And without ice in the Arctic, it's difficult for me to imagine that we will have humans on the planet for very long. And I'm not the only person who thinks that. The president of Finland, in a joint press conference with Donald Trump on August 28th of this year, said, quote, "If we lose the Arctic, we lose the globe," end quote. So we've dodged five bullets in as many years. I doubt the trend continues much longer. And even if it does, we still won't have a human being on the planet in another 8 or 10 years because of exponential climate change. And I just don't see us persisting. I don't see ice persisting in the Arctic for much longer. You remember, we have to go back more than 3 million years to find an ice-free Arctic, and 300,000 years with humans on the planet. So we have never, as a species, as humans, experienced an ice-free Arctic, and I can't even imagine a situation in which we could for very long, because that's a harbinger, an indicator of a planet that is completely different than the one we are experiencing right now.
And that's where we run the risk of having the 50 gigaton methane discharge that's been hypothesized by Natalia Shukova and Igor Semilatov from the University of Fairbanks in Alaska. They've been warning about that for a long time. Peter Wadhams and his team at the Arctic Methane Emergency Group have been warning about it a long time. And the IPCC virtually ignores the threat. And I suspect they do that because it is an existential threat, and it's one that can't be controlled at this late stage. So they've effectively decided that their strategy will be hope. They will hope it doesn't happen.
It's that old adage, right? Prepare for the worst, hope for the best. And whereas one can make some preparations for the worst, hoping isn't going to solve anything. So hoping is wishful thinking. And I am afraid that that's exactly what the captains of industry are relying upon going forward, is hope, wishful thinking, crossing our fingers. Well, I'd rather we not. And since we aren't going to do anything substantive in terms of action, why don't we just tell people? Why don't we warn people that what's coming is truly unprecedented, that there is no reason to expect humans to persist on a planet with essentially no other or very little complex life. So why can't we have that conversation? Why can't we have a leader of the political world step up and say, you know, I'm not going to be doing this job much longer because there won't be humans on the planet much longer, so I'm here to tell you what I think is actually happening. Would that be asking too much? Yes, I suppose it is. The Kennedy treatment comes to mind.
I struggle with that whole concept so much because I'm a sailor, and one of the things that us sailors do is we follow the precautionary principle all the time. If the wind starts building, we make sure we're not going to be oversheeted and not going to have too much sail up. We prepare for the worst, and I find it extraordinary that the scientific community aren't preparing for the worst and aren't talking about what the worst case scenarios are and how we can deal with it. But under the capitalist system and the infinite growth paradigm, that kind of preventative and cautionary approach is just thrown into the dustbin of history. It's just about rape and pillage, and let's just get what we can while we can.
It's almost as if money is what really matters.
I'm glad you brought some humor into the discussion. I promised everyone that we'd bring some gallows humor to the table.
You know, my whole
How life... else would we get through this without some degree of gallows humor?
Yeah, that's true. You know, when we were kids, Kevin, and we're what, a week apart in age, it wasn't all about the money all the time. People actually adhered to principles, regardless of the money. And now, I'm not sure I could find a recent example of somebody adhering to principle, no matter what the principle is, if there was money involved that would get in the way. It's interesting, there's a 12-year-old on the homestead I occupy, probably the smartest person I've ever met, certainly among the most knowledgeable and the most humorous, and he asked me, he pitched something to me and asked me how much money, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, none. There isn't enough money that would cause me to do that. And he said, really? And I said, well, let's put it this way. If somebody promised to kill somebody on your behalf, how much money would you take for them to do that? And he says, I would never do that. I said, right, because you're 12 years old and you have principles. He hasn't been so contaminated by the monetary situation that he has abandoned his own principles. And that's a naive and rare and innocent and wonderful opportunity to be part of, is to see a 12-year-old who still has principles. And I wonder how much longer that's going to last for him.
Absolutely. That's a wonderful story. Hat tip to that young fella.
Yeah. He's just the most wonderful, magnanimous human being perhaps I've ever met. And he's clever and smart and funny as hell. And he goes around and tells jokes to adults, and he has the timing down just perfect. He's an incredible human being. You know, and for the most part, when we see the things that we see, when we see the Donald Trump phenomenon in Puerto Rico, when we see humans acting as if money is the most important thing that has ever happened in the history of the world, all of us are inclined to say, yeah, well, we kind of deserve human extinction. And then we come across somebody like Marshall, the 12-year-old, and we think, but he doesn't. You know, he's just this relative, innocent, hilarious young man who does not deserve what's coming his way, I promise.
I'm very critical of industrial sapiens, and I've made that distinction in recent times because it's only a very, very small number of us who are responsible for this Armageddon. It's the economic system, it's the people, it works its way down. But the vast majority of sapiens on this planet are innocent victims of our crack-like addiction to carbon. And we have to be careful not to delegate that blame to everybody.
No, that's absolutely right. And to paint humans even with a broad brush is to miss the point that civilized humans, industrial civilized humans, are completely different than humans that have come before. So yes, this is a very different group, a very different phenomenon than we've ever observed before. And it's easy for us to paint with a broad brush. In fact, you see this in cartoons all the time. People making comments about humans when really I think they mean a much narrower group of humans than all of them. And, you know, to throw 12-year-old Marshall into the same kettle as the likes of Donald Trump and the people really pulling the strings of empire, and even you and I, Kevin Hester and Guy McPherson, is an abomination.
And the million people that are facing cholera in Yemen at the moment are almost completely and utterly innocent of A, the war that is raining down on them, and B, the ecological catastrophe that's taking place around them. I spent quite a bit of time in Africa. I worked on a development project in Mozambique during the war in 1991. And the carbon footprint of the city that I was living in was extraordinarily low because it had been bombed into submission. And in anything that used fossil fuels or carbon was already destroyed. Sure, people were burning down the last trees because they had to cook food, but those people are largely completely innocent of this catastrophe. And those of us who live in the affluent or effluent West need to take responsibility and own up.
Yeah, you know, and when I spoke weekly in my college classes about human population and consumption, I would point out that there's a difference between having two children in the United States and having two children in the Republic of Congo, for example, or almost anywhere on the continent of Africa. That at the time, having a single baby and projecting through the lifetime of that human being in the United States was the equivalent of having 37 Kenyans on the planet. And afterwards, one of my students came up and introduced me to her 37 children, who happened to be named Sarah, which I thought was kind of funny. And she went on to have two, just like all of my other students, completely missing the message that there's something important going on here, and you might want to think twice, or maybe six times, before you have that first, second, third, fourth, and fifth child.
It's so... my heart goes out to people who wanted to follow the normal paradigm of falling in love, making babies, and having a family, and the daunting prospect that those people are confronted with, looking at what's happening with our ecology and the carbon footprint that every new child brings to the world. It must be a very depressing and challenging time for those people.
Of course, of course. And you know, trying to overcome evolution is a fool's game. And so, of course, we are evolutionarily, through natural selection, we are forced, for all practical purposes, to procreate. That's just, if we weren't, then we wouldn't have those genes. Those genes for non-procreation dropped out. So, of course, we are driven really, really, really hard by not just the culture, not just our personal history, our personal upbringing, but also by evolution through natural selection to procreate. That's what got us here. That's what made us so, quote, successful as a species, successful enough to destroy the entire living biosphere. And so, you know, even Nietzsche gave up on the idea of the Übermensch or the Superman or the Overman late in his career. I think because he came to recognize that our inability through rational acts to overcome our virtual absence of free will as dictated by evolution was just too much. It's just too much. So I don't get the impression here that I'm blaming people who have children. That's not my point at all. My point is that I spent 21 years in the classroom encouraging students to think really hard before they brought another human being on the planet. And as near as I can tell, there was relatively little thought and a lot of really fun sex involved that followed. And here we are with double the human population of when I started teaching those classes.
There's a certain irony in why I don't have children. And I suppose in a macabre way, I can think Big Pharma and the nuclear industry. When I was a young fella growing up in the Waikato, the farming community of New Zealand, of Matamata, I sprayed a insecticide called Paraquat, a herbicide called Paraquat, and it used to blow back over me. And then on the hot summer's day, I think, oh, it's so refreshing and cool. Then, of course, years later, I found out what it was doing to my genetic structure. And then on the 26th of April, 1986, I was in Istanbul on the day that Chernobyl blew up.
Uh-huh.
And I was irradiated. And pretty much at that time, I decided I wouldn't have children because of the dangers that were involved in it. On the subject of nuclear, I'd like to let our listeners know that in coming programs, I will be interviewing Paul Gunter from beyondnuclear.org and Mimi Gehrman from radcast.org. And Mimi has been a guest on the show previously, and she'll be happy to come on again. I think we're just about to wrap now, folks. It's been a pleasure talking with you, Guy. Look after yourself and stay cool till after school.
Thanks, Kevin. It's a joy, as always, to talk to you. I'll be here anytime you want. So anytime you want me to call from Belize, you'll get those birds in the background. I look forward to it.
Wonderful. Wonderful background. We'll hand it over to you, studio. Thank you very much.
Mother Nature.
That's almost 52 years so far, the world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water than the year before. Every year there's been less clean air than there was the year before that. Every year there are fewer species on the planet than the year before that. We're driving 200 species a day to extinction. We're about to see that turn around. The loving planet is about to make a comeback. And that's really, really good news.
She bats last and she's coming out swinging. She bats.